On Air with George Adair on News Talk 1350 and the new FM 103.5 KSRO.
Well, hello there. Happy Wednesday, everybody. This is an exciting show for me because I enjoy this guest so much. Dr. Robert Eiler with Sonoma State University. Repeat guest. It's been a little bit. I think we kind of bridged over the whole COVID time period. And now we're into the next phase of recovery and economically and where we're going to head. And, you know, we're seeing so much in the headlines and news. I wanted to bring in a local perspective to talk with us today. And thank you, Dr. Eiler, for joining us. How have you been?
I've been good, George. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, I always enjoy having you. Plethora of information. I always have to prepare for this show because I'm always feel like I'm being tested. Make sure I get the terms right, Dr. Eiler. It's been a bit.
No
worries. And as I've joked before, I did take microeconomics twice at the University of San Diego. Dr. Eiler, there's so much happening, and we could, you know, fill hours and hours of lecture and conversation about what's happening in the economics of the world, the economy, micro and macro. But, you know, I think I'd just kind of like to start with people getting a bit of an understanding and perspective from you of just the topic of inflation and the correlation to interest rates. Why are we seeing such aggressive moves from Chairman Powell and the Federal Reserve with regards to interest rates while people are still really struggling to afford to live and worried about their next paycheck?
No, it's a great question. Thank you for asking. So here's the basic way of thinking about it. One way that the Federal Reserve is going to view interest rates as they're not high enough versus the actual inflation and the inflation risk to borrowers and lenders. So by forcing interest rates up, it's also making financial markets reckon with how inflation may affect the purchasing power or the real value of investments that have been made.
Yeah.
And it's meant to really readjust an economy that may not have dealt with the inflation just yet. The other side of it is that if inflation is a function of how much we're spending, then by increasing interest rates, I'm reversing the incentive to spend, both for businesses and consumers. So what's tough about that, and everything has an opportunity cost.
Right.
That what's tough about that is as you increase interest rates, if your intention is to slow down spending, you're basically saying that to slow down the ascension of inflation, I'm going to have to slow down the growth of the economy.
And we find that people tend to keep their cash and not spend because they also are scared of what's happening, right?
Yeah, and furthermore, if the rate of interest that you can get on something that's very close to cash, like let's say a government treasury security, because of its ability to be, you know, to be liquid or to find a buyer for it if you needed the cash, and the fact that it's relatively low risk, at least the way the financial markets look at it. That's going to attract you to save more than you would be consuming if you want to see it that way. So on the margin, as interest rates go up, it's meant to attract more savings and slow down consumption, which are kind of sister acts of each other, if you want to put it that way.
That's
what you're seeing.
Yeah.
And that's part of the slowdown.
That is part of the slowdown. And I think we have to go back in time just a few years to see the previous Fed behavior, which was a do-nothing behavior. And leave interest rates really, really low for an extended period of time because they thought maybe inflation was transitory. Can you talk to us? What did that really mean?
Yeah, what it meant is that the belief is that most of the inflation was more on the supply side than the demand side.
Mm-hmm.
So if supply chains clean themselves up and started to deliver against the increase in spending and sort of the recovery momentum we had coming out of the pandemic, then the inflation was really more of a transitory or a movement between a locked up inefficient supply side of the market to one that now is seeing that they need to produce more and would, in a sense, naturally make adjustments to COVID and satiate the increase in demand.
Yeah.
What we've realized is that, in fact, that hasn't quite happened yet. And at the same time, we probably put larger incentives to spend in the economy than we should have, and then we're getting this sort of double whammy because inflation happens when demand is greater than supply. If supply is contracting while demand is expanding, you get much more quick movements in price.
And now we're seeing sort of the result of a delayed response to those pressures you're talking about, where all of a sudden we're seeing the fastest rise in interest rate hikes than I think we've seen in recent recorded memory, right?
Yeah, it's probably the mid-1990s when we had somewhat of a similar ascension. In the mid-2000s, it was close. But yeah, this is a really fast pace. And usually when we teach and write about central banking, we usually say you should not raise rates at this pace. But to your point before about the transition in sort of the let's do nothing phase, one of the things that economists were jumping up and down about, you know, let's say 15 months ago, so kind of when inflation really started to show its face and take off, was that there should have been an immediate change in terms of Federal Reserve policy of slowly coming off the lower bound of zero and start walking up maybe a quarter point every meeting.
Right.
Rather than these jumbo changes, because what those jumbo changes do, and you may get to this in a second, is really shift the way that businesses, investors, and consumers all think about expectations. And they're not really shaping the news correctly. They're just sort of saying, we're going to do everything we can, but we're not going to really tell you when we're going to stop, and we're not going to tell you how big the jumps are going to be. We're just going to say we're now kind of overcorrecting for undercorrecting in the first place.
Yeah, and we're seeing the Fed tell us is we took too long, now we need to overcorrect. And I think that they're ignoring is the natural response to these interest rate hikes is it does take, what, 3-6+ months to see it actually trickle back into the inflationary numbers?
Yeah, I mean, there's millions of pages written about this, but yeah. Somewhere between 6 to 12 months is the so-called policy lag in terms of the change in the rate and it actually started to show its face. So to that end, we've already seen about 6 months on from the original increase, we're actually seeing now more downward momentum in prices.
Uh-huh.
But George, so much of that depends on how much the increase in prices is demand.
Right.
If the increase in price is supply side or supply chain driven based on inefficiencies that exist between dirt and retail, regardless of what you produce, the trick is you're not going to be able to use monetary policy to solve that problem. And in fact, you can exacerbate the problem if you're forcing the cost of doing business to go up, where I might have been able to borrow and try to solve that inefficiency. Mm-hmm. Now the cost of borrowing has gone up.
That's something that we're not hearing a lot of, actually. I think that's a really good point. You may be the first person I've heard actually bring that up. Is the almost an inverse reaction. Borrowing is how businesses frankly operate. And when I think what we're talking about, Michelle, is that consumers borrow at different rates than businesses borrow at. Isn't that right, Dr. Eiler? I mean, businesses leverage warehouse, you know, facilities and lines of credit, whereas consumers leverage credit cards and auto loans. It's completely different leveraging, isn't it?
100%. I mean, a business should be leveraging with the idea that they have to make a profit off of what they borrow. A consumer leverages against the sort of ethereal belief that the benefits they're going to get from using their credit card are going to outpace what it's going to cost them.
Right. So I think that kind of brings me to another question. Historically, how does a recession impact unemployment and wages? It seems like a double whammy to the average American that's trying to keep up with inflationary prices, like, you know, costs of milk and cookies and my beer index, of course, and more importantly, yeah. More recently, fuel again. While they're hoping to keep their job.
Yeah, so here's the idea. Inflation is a regressive tax.
Mm.
So as prices go up, our lower to middle income households are hurt more. They generally are going to be the first jobs to be shed because if you think of prices showing their face at retail points of sale or in personal services more completely than in sort of other parts of the economy that might be buying and selling goods as part of a broader production or personal or professional services process, if those folks lose their job first, then they're more vulnerable across both sides. So one of the things about that, because there's always, again, a trade-off, is that if inflation starts to subside, but wages do not slow down or potentially just stop growing as fast but continue to grow, the two will kind of meet each other and will give lower-income folks more purchasing power, and generally speaking, all of us more purchasing power.
Mm-hmm.
But the trick in that is it's also increased the real cost to business of purchasing more of your time.
Right.
So that's going to mean, and to your point before, usually when recession happens and we see prices slowing down, we also see employment slowing down because the number one reason why we would see prices contracting is because businesses and consumers are buying less stuff.
Right.
Even if you're getting more from your wage because inflation has slowed down, whether or not you keep your job or not is going to depend on where the direction of the entire macroeconomy is going in kind of a hand-wavy way. So that's unemployment should rise. And so we have a lot of economists out there including me in the sense that we knew this was going to have to happen, that as interest rates are rising in terms of combating the inflation, the trade-off was going to be some job loss.
Right.
How much job loss and when and in what sectors of the economy? I mean, if I knew that, you and I wouldn't be on the phone. I'd be trading in those sectors right now
right.
and shorting them in such a way to make, you know, billions of dollars.
Right.
Nobody knows that with precision, but we feel like all the conditions are there to see some job losses. The key is how and what sectors and what's the magnitude going to be.
Does it seem that the underlying fundamentals of our economy are strong and that the only thing we're most concerned about is inflation right now?
Yeah, the labor market has shown really strong resilience. And this is kind of the weird thing about how we reacted to the pandemic, in the sense that we really did kind of shut off the supply side of the economy versus the demand, even though one kind of begets the other. But the trick is, when we turned the economy back on, people who had spent less and not lost their job, or had spent less and now gotten this infusion of government money and or lower interest rates, had this huge incentive to go out and spend again.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, we didn't clean up the supply side, and that's where the transitory inflation really got in the way. So if you look at it from a real economy standpoint, we have issues in terms of our ability to satiate demand, and so until we get those supply side issues, and it's a globalized market now, so if East Asia continues to have very strange, episodic, weird policies in terms of how they're reacting to a couple of cases of COVID,
mm-hmm.
that can have ripple effects onto our ports, through our distribution chains, into our retailers,
right.
as well as what's going on in Eastern Europe. So the thing about inflation is that we're probably on the downhill slide generally, but there's geopolitics and general politics worldwide that might keep it elevated for the time being. Otherwise, if you look at household balance sheets, if you look at what's happened with people's augmented wealth with respect to, yes, we've lost in the equity markets, but we've gained a lot also. And also in housing, we're starting to slip a little bit. We're in somewhat better shape than how we entered the last recession, for sure, in terms of the overall financial picture. But there are still some inherent risks in the economy when we've had this much volatility over the last 2.5 years.
All great insight. We're going to go to a quick commercial break. We'll be back with Dr. Robert Eiler of Sonoma State University in just a moment. Thanks.
On Air with George Adair on News Talk 1350 and the new FM 103.5 KSRO.
DJ Sash and Glass is a full-service residential window and glass company. DJ's has served Sonoma County since 1960, and we're three generations strong. Going forward, we'll continue to adhere to all county health and safety protocols. We're ready to help you with your shower door, window, and glass projects. DJ's is a certified Milgard window dealer with our own in-house installers that can install your fiberglass or vinyl windows. And we specialize in custom shower doors. We'll get your window or shower door quote done and back to you within 48 hours. We provide professional services and look forward to the opportunity to serve you. Add a touch of class to your glass. Call DJ's Sash and Glass today for windows and your shower door replacement. With DJ's Sash and Glass, 2985 Wilgin Court,
Sonoma County. Santa Rosa. This is George Adair for Cross Country Mortgage. I'm excited to announce Fast Track is back. That's right. This 10-day mortgage closing program, offered exclusively by Cross Country Mortgage, will help you win the deal. With a fully underwritten loan approval, your offer looks as strong as cash. Fast Track buyers have more purchasing power, 10-day closings, and give the seller and realtors peace of mind with no lender surprises. Fast Track works for first-time home buyers and investors. In this competitive market, buyers need every advantage to win the deal. So if your current pre-approval isn't winning your deal, get on the Fast Track with my team at Cross Country Mortgage. Just call me, George Adair, at 707-583-8100. That's 707-583-8100. Or get started quickly online at georgiadair.com. You can get on the Fast Track at georgiadair.com.
Cross Country Mortgage, NMLS 3029, and George Adair, NMLS 245370. NMLS, consumeraccess.org. Equal housing opportunity, subject to credit approval.
On Air with George Adair on News Talk 1350 and the new FM 103.5, KSRO.
And thanks for joining us today. I'm George Adair. We do the show live every Wednesday at noon, and you can always check our podcasts at ksro.com. Just navigate your way through to the Ask the Expert series. You'll find my page there. Michelle does an excellent job producing the show and then putting them online. And if you're joining us on Facebook, welcome. Thanks for joining us today on Facebook, too. We have an incredible guest today, Dr. Robert Eiler, professor of economics at Sonoma State University. Just our general local economic guru that many organizations lean on. Including the Board of Realtors in past studies, I think, right, Dr. Eiler? You've worked with the Realtor Group in the past, haven't you?
Yes.
That's great. And that gives us some sort of connectivity here to the housing market. Let's see here, which question I want to move to. I think that I would really like to talk with you about contrasting and comparing national headline news to what's happening locally, just sort of setting it up that home prices, inflation, and unemployment, they locally compared to nationally seem to be just different in my experience and the numbers I see. I mean, I just saw a $2.5 million house go on the market and get in contract in 5 days in Windsor. But I don't see the same data points acknowledged by the press nationally. What insights do you offer our listeners here about the current economic climate compared to what they're reading in the headlines?
Well, I think most of the headlines are true in the sense of generally where the economy is going. Mm-hmm. I think that the headline news is that we are in a situation where inflation remains relatively high, interest rates are on the rise to try to combat it. We should expect folks to start losing their jobs. How much, like I said before the break, and in what sectors is really the big question of the hour. And the trick is whether or not those job losses will be large enough to create what we think of as a declared recession. So we're currently in technical recession, based on what happened the first two quarters with respect to GDP growth. But to your point, it may not really feel recessionary locally. Mm-hmm. If you think about the travel season, how much vibrancy we've seen in Sonoma County in terms of our downtown areas over the last 6 months, mm-hmm. what's happening still with housing markets in the sense that we haven't seen, you know, a real contraction yet there. Even though it's a little tricky to think that they're going to be able to hold at these peaks for much longer, given the change in the interest rates and the slowdown in some parts of the lending market. But, you know, it's going to be our area because it is really a suburb of a much larger, amazing metropolitan area. We haven't really seen the effects start to hit here yet. But what you have seen is you've seen losses in portfolios.
Uh-huh.
You have seen losses in some housing markets, though they've been relatively small so far. And in some places, even in tech, you've seen, you know, announcements and or explicit job loss. So how that wave starts to roll through the economy, Sonoma County tends to be about maybe a 4 to 6 month lag of the national and state evolution in the economy, and then takes about 4 to 6 months to come out of it slower than other parts because of the way we're sort of balanced all the way across sectors from agriculture down to government.
Interesting. I've never heard that before.
Historically, that tends to be our cycle.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. And I think there's also, you know, other markets that lead the cycle differently, right? And you got second home markets like Bend, Oregon and Scottsdale and, you know, Eagle, Idaho. Those are areas where their housing markets are absolutely almost crashing. I hesitate to say because I don't believe in sensationalism in the headlines. But, you know, you're seeing those types of 20-30% drops. Here, we're just not seeing home price drops. Do you feel like the housing market can weather this locally? Do you have a pulse on that?
I think it'll weather it better than other places that maybe saw the surge of this, you know, diaspora, if you will, of people that could, you know, sort of work wherever they wanted to, or at least had the assumption 2.5 years ago that that was going to be the case. And then there's this sort of reshift. I mean, you could even think, you know, if I knew I was going to be able to work remotely, I might have looked at Boise as a place to land in June 2020.
Right.
Then you watch a 40% run-up in prices from the day I bought my house, and they say, well, maybe what I should do is now take these gains and go back.
Right.
Especially if I don't know if my employer is going to allow me to stay in Boise at the same salary.
Right.
So how much of that generalizes itself and starts to affect these smaller markets that really had a large receipt of Californians and generally speaking, people that live in metro areas all over the place,
mm-hmm.
who suddenly had an incentive or an explicit ability to work remotely.
Yeah.
How that then starts to shift against, like you said, those second homes. So like if I bought my primary residence, maybe I'll dump it and take the gains and get out.
Right. And hopefully you're the first one in the neighborhood, not the fifth one, right?
You got it. Exactly.
You know, I like to talk a little bit about the people's approach to homeownership seems to be often so short term. Today, I've been talking about how, you know, interest rates today, Dr. Eiler, we're seeing average homes just this week, 30-year fixed interest rates for homes, kind of going in the mid 6.5% to 7% interest rate range. And people are, it's almost like they day trade their house expectations. They're like, oh, I got to buy today and sell tomorrow. And, you know, real estate's a long play, isn't it? Isn't that, I mean, right. I'm not asking for financial advice, but economically speaking, trend lines seem to do better over a long run than over the next 1 to 2 years, right?
100%. And just like equity markets, we tend to get a stomach ache if we lose $1 and we tend to forget we made $1,000.
Yeah.
So it's amazing to watch people and their reaction to losses versus gains, because we all expect to gain. We don't expect to lose. And that basic human phenomenon is something where equity and housing markets, which are basically two sides of the same coin,
yeah,
really showcase that sense in humans. So that's, you're right. You've got to play it long and you've got to see it that way. However, the latest conditions, the last 2.5 years, have allowed people to do a little bit more day trading style.
Right, right. And flipping houses and whatnot is something that people have become part of their portfolios, actually. But it gets a little more dangerous as you enter a recession. But where it doesn't get dangerous, in my experience, I'd love to hear if you correlate with me on this, is coming out of many of the last, 5 or 6 recessions that I've looked at, home prices go back up and interest rates, they come back down. Isn't that generally the correct correlation?
Well, 100%. I mean, and if they just follow a simple business cycle, they're not necessarily 100% correlated to what we think of as a classic business cycle, the evolution of incomes and employment.
Right.
But they follow behind or maybe a little bit in front, depending on where you are.
Right.
So absolutely. So you should expect that. It's just like any other equity market on the housing side. And then, you know, interest rates are basically a reflection of the cost of making that choice about how you borrow or save.
Right.
So you should expect those evolutions, just like with the other parts of the economy.
And I think that's where people need to not be short-sighted in real estate investing specifically. I think it's a great place to put their money right now. Maybe in the short term, it's more expensive. Well, it is, not maybe. It is more expensive than it was 8 months ago to buy a house. When you look at the interest rates, but if you look at the stats on this, every 3 to 5 years, people buy or refinance their mortgage. So get the 7% rate now and then look forward to a nice, you know, maybe on average, I think it was 2.5% decrease in rates after a recessionary period's over. So, you know, the speculation isn't so risky when you look at the history. It's more risky when you look at it the 1 month out, 2 month out.
Absolutely. But I will tell you this, is that to maybe put a small caveat, because I agree with everything you said, but I want to add just a little bit of frosting to it, is this, is that we also should not expect that we're going to go back down to the zero lower bound again,
right,
as a regular practice.
Yeah.
So one of the things the last two recessions has really done, and this will be very intriguing to watch as interest rates go back down again, what the expectations are, is that, well, maybe I'm not going to refi because, to tell you the truth, I'm just going to wait for the rate to go back down like it was in 2020 or in 2009.
Right.
Right, because I mean, you know that they're going to push it back down there again, and we don't remember that those were emergency procedures, mm-hmm, on a serious problem in the body economic, if you want to put it that way.
Never seen before, and probably won't be seen again.
Well, but here's the trick, George, is that unfortunately the last two recession episodes have had that outcome, and we left it there for a little while rather than saying, okay, we did it for 6 months. We kind of told you that we want to juice the economy again, but now we're going to slowly lift off. We're not going to lift off fast, but we're going to lift off a little bit. In the Great Recession case, it took us basically about 7 years to go from the initial zero lower bound to the beginning of the liftoff.
Yep, too long.
Now, in this case, it took us too, and maybe it took us too long this time also, but what that tells you, especially think of it this way, the story I tell is this, is I had 18-year-olds in 2008 that saw zero lower bound for 7 years of their adult life.
Yeah.
They saw it again in 2020.
Right.
So now they're going to be thinking, if I'm buying a house, I'm now 35 and I have kids, why am I going to do this until I actually see those interest rates come all the way back down again? That's the dangerous play here. But you nailed it. I mean, the idea is that if you get in now and refinance, you should be okay.
Yeah. I tell people, my latest message right now is just buy if you can afford. If you can afford it and you're going to live there, then great, buy. No one looks back 2 years ago or 3 years ago and says, shoot, I wish I didn't buy back then. They're like, cool, I bought back then, and they had a nice interest rate run for a short term. If you want to buy today, buy today, and then worry about refinancing when the inevitable happens, which is rates will come down after the recessionary period's over. Do you think that's prudent advice?
It is. I would just say this, and this is the trick that gets people very myopic, is that if I don't know how long I can stay in the house from an income standpoint because maybe my job is somewhat tricky to keep, or I just feel like that I won't be able to find another economic opportunity if I lose my job here in this area. My idea about the long run with my house is going to become much more short-sighted. So that's where you see that sort of maybe $400,000 to $700,000 home evolution about the way people look at that. And that's, if the walls start to crumble on the market, it'll probably be there first because of job loss, then let's say on the higher end because people are kind of day trading relatively expensive properties.
Well, I think you and I just adopted a new term, day trading real estate. Well, Dr. Eiler, much appreciated. Thank you so much. Love to have you back as we watch these cycles continue.
Just let me know. I appreciate it. Thanks so much, George.
All right, folks. Thank you so much, Dr. Eiler. Again, academia extraordinaire from Sonoma State University. Such a great guest to have. Great insight. Folks, we're going to have this show at ksro.com. I encourage you to go back and check it out. We'll also have it on our Facebook page. You can find us online on Facebook, of course. That's it. I'm getting the hook. I'm just still on my high right now. Hey, folks, thanks for joining us today. I'm George Adair. We'll be back next Wednesday at noon. Be good.